If you read Herodotus, the Greek historian, and I read it from secondary sources, Xerxes was a vile man. He was a man that was given to bouts of temper. I could go through stories. I mean, when he lost his temper, people were executed. There was a time when there was a bridge that was built, and a storm came up and destroyed the bridge. And Xerxes, in a fit of rage, demanded that his people go out and lash the water 300 times. And then he ultimately beheaded the engineers who built the bridge. That's one of the more modest stories of what he did. I could go into other accounts, but it suffice it to say that Xerxes was known for being an angry man, a short-tempered man, a very difficult, very egotistical individual. But that's a matter of ancient history. Well, Vashti didn't show, and so this was a form of embarrassment. The king says, Ahasuerus, what shall I do? And he calls his counselors, and they say, well, clearly this isn't good, because now, as dignitaries, when our wives hear that Vashti didn't show, that they will be inclined to follow her example. And so we've got to teach them by way of example that our wives should follow. This is a ridiculous story, but that's exactly the counsel that he received. So we've got to depose Vashti, and that's exactly what happened. And Vashti was never again to be appearing before King Ahasuerus or King Xerxes. And so this was his counsel, and then he sobers up in chapter 2 and recognizes what he's done. It begins, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what he'd done, and now what do I do? And so he got more counsel, and so they begin to summon young ladies from the 127 provinces. His empire ranged all the way from what we would call Iran and Iraq, and all the way to Ethiopia. I mean, the entire ancient Near East was dominated by Persia. It was a sprawling empire of 127 provinces. So they summoned these young ladies and sent them to beauty school, and then each of them appeared before the king in sequence. And there was a young Jewish woman by the name of Hadassah. That's her Hebrew name. Her Persian name is Esther, and there are different explanations about where that name came from, but Esther was summoned to, she was entered in the beauty contest, and so she was prepared for her time with Ahasuerus, and went through the preparatory rites and so on, and so she went in and pleased the king, and it turns out in chapter 2 that she becomes the queen. This occurs in chapter 2. So now you have Ahasuerus having deposed Vashti, and now Esther is his new wife. What a daunting task that must have been. But in any event, she becomes his bride. And verse 17 says, the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So his affections clearly were drawn to her. She had an uncle, Mordecai. Mordecai was from the tribe of Benjamin, and it actually of the same family line, interestingly enough, as Saul, who was also of the king of the line of Benjamin. And so remember those two names. Those two names fit together. Those two names have to be remembered together, Mordecai and his young distant relative Esther, or Hadassah is her Hebrew name. Well, it happens, and I say it happens. This is an expression that you may hear, it happens. When you hear the expression, it happens, or by chance, as Christians, we know that things don't just, quote-unquote, happen, and nothing occurs, quote-unquote, by chance. And so I'm tipping the cards a little bit here. This is an example. There's many examples. We'll explore these as we go through the book, of God's hand at work. The king's name, by the way, appears, I didn't count them, but I read this in more than one source, 192 times in this book. God's name and his other titles that might be given to him does not appear a single time. And so this has been troubling to some, that God's name does not appear, but there's a very simple explanation. His handiwork is everywhere to be seen. So Mordecai has an important role. He is stationed outside the gate. He is not a premier figure in the government, but he's given the task of sitting outside the gate. And so he's in a position to hear a lot of things and see a lot of things. And one of those things that he happens, quote-unquote, to hear, so I'm going to quit saying quote-unquote. Every time you hear the word happens, understand that I'm using that in a providential way, because a lot of things happen, and they're all providential. They're all evidences of God's hand. It occurs, it happens, that Mordecai overhears a discussion among two insurrectionists who were plotting the assassination of the king, and he reveals that to Esther. Mordecai without Esther would not have been effective. Esther without Mordecai would not have been effective. And so in God's providence, you have Mordecai stationed outside the gate, and now you have Esther firmly situated inside the palace itself. Although the relationship that she has, like any person in Persia at that time, a tenuous relationship, the rule was that if you went into the inner chamber uninvited, that it was a de facto death sentence. That could be spared, however, if Ahasuerus extended his golden scepter to you, you were spared. But you began with the premise that the minute you walked into the inner chamber uninvited, that you were going to be killed. That's where you started with that premise. And so the question is, would you be spared? That will occur more importantly in a bit. So there is this discovery of this this conspiracy, and it is revealed to the king. And the conspirators are dealt with summarily. They are executed. And then you have Haman, and we're not going to do any more of the sound, but Haman is now exalted, raised up to a position of influence in chapter 3. He is an Amalekite. Understand that this harkens back to this very long hatred between Israel and Amalek. It goes all the way back to Israel coming into the land, and Amalek treated, to say harshly, they would attack them from the rear, they would exploit them, they murdered them, they took the lives of the innocent, the weak, and God said, wipe them out. You may remember that Saul was set aside as king because he explicitly failed to execute Agag, the Amalekite king, and so Samuel did his handiwork for him. But you have this antipathy between Israel and Amalek that's been going on for centuries. And so now you've got Haman, who is an Amalekite, and you've got Mordecai, a Benjamite, and they're interacting with each other. But Mordecai refuses, contrary to the king's directive, to genuflect every time he sees Haman appear. When Haman appears, the people are supposed to bow down and pay reverence. Don't know exactly what that meant, but clearly it meant that they were recognizing him as a supreme person. And Mordecai refused to do that. Well, that inflamed the ire of Haman, and Haman decided that he would go to the king. He was now in a position to do this and say, we have this group of people that are scattered all throughout your empire. They have different laws. They do not subordinate themselves to your authority. And so we need to get rid of them entirely, the entire people. And so the king extends his signet ring, seals the rule, the law, and the law of the Medes and the Persians, as you may know, it was irrevocable, and so once there was a pronouncement, not even the king could curtail his own pronouncement. So this was etched in stone, so to speak, that we're going to wipe out all of the Jewish people. The hatred of Haman towards Mordecai could have been just, I'm just going to get rid of Mordecai, and later that was his intent. But he said, no, it's more than that. I'm just going to wipe out all the people, all the Jews. And so this, of course, you have to be thinking about this hatred between Israel and Amalek that runs throughout the entire book. Well, Mordecai, again, enters the figure. He hears this story. He sees the decree. It's issued. It's couriered through horsemen all throughout the different provinces of Persia, and the people in Susa are puzzled. They don't understand what's going on. Mordecai is grief-stricken for obvious reasons, and tears his clothing, is in dust and ashes, he's in mourning. And then he goes to Esther, communicates through an intermediary to Esther, and says that presumably she was not aware of this or it wasn't on her radar screen at this point, but he entreats her to go to the king and seek relief. And so there is this intermediary, Hathach, who is a messenger in between Mordecai, who's at the gate, and Esther, who is the queen. This is in chapter 4. Well, Esther communicates back to Mordecai, understand that if I go into his inner court and I've not been invited, that it's a death sentence unless he extends the golden scepter. So fast for me. It doesn't say pray, it just says fast for me. That's another thing. The prayer per se is not specifically mentioned. That troubles some people. It need not trouble you. I'm sure that they were praying to the Lord God Almighty. And so Mordecai responds in chapter 4, back through this intermediary, please understand, Esther, that if you fail to take action, that relief for Israel will come through some other place, but you yourself and your family will not be spared. Who knows, and this is the wording that is so often cited, who knows whether perhaps for this hour you have been raised to this occasion. And that's exactly right. And so she has them intercede for her along with her maidens to fast. And she says, in these words, you know, she says, if I perish, I perish. So I'm leaving this in God's hands. She doesn't say that, but that's clearly what she's doing. And then you have a banquet. So she goes to the king. She puts her life at risk. She enters the court. And she enjoys the favor. The king says, what would you wish? And so he extends the scepter to her. And she says in chapter 5, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come to this banquet that I prepared. And so the king immediately summons Haman and let's go to this banquet. And they gather together. And what is your wish? Anything up to half the kingdom? This is a man of grand statements. He does everything in a big way. And so she says, well, come again. We'll have another banquet, and I'll tell you what I want. It seems a bit strange, but again, this is the providence of God, that she didn't disclose what her request was at that precise time. Well, so Haman goes out, and he's all puffed up because he's been invited to a private banquet with the queen and the king, and he's feeling pretty good about himself in chapter 5. And who does he see as he goes outside the gates? But Mordecai, and Mordecai characteristically does not bow down and grant favor. So he just becomes livid with hatred again, goes home and vents to his wife and his friends. You won't believe what took place. Mordecai continues to fail to honor me. And so the counsel that he received from his wife was we'll build a gallows. We'll just get him hung. And that's the end of chapter 5. So this idea was very pleasing to Haman, and they immediately went out and had this gallows constructed. Well, chapter 6, more providence. So you've got the king suffering insomnia. And what does he request in the wee hours of the morning? But they didn't have melatonin, and they didn't have other things. So he says, bring the book, the history books of I'm going to read to me about all of the chronicles. We'll zero in on that. But lo and behold, that's another term for providence. What does he read, or what does he have read to him? But the story about how Mordecai had disclosed this conspiracy to take his own life. And, well, what would we do for that guy? And the answer, we haven't done anything for him, which, again, is providence. The reward for Mordecai had yet to be manifest. And, well, we've got to do something about that. And we've got to. So he says, well, who's in the king's court? Well, Haman. Well, again, more providence. He's there. Well, look, tell him to come in. And so you can imagine the embarrassment. But what do you think Haman has said? Well, what would you do if we really wanted to honor someone in our kingdom for doing something heroic, and Haman thought it was him, probably, and so he conjured up this tremendous thing. Well, let's parade this person all throughout the city and sing accolades to this person, and he should be displayed with grandeur, etc. Great idea, the king says, and we need to do that for Mordecai. Can you imagine Haman's response at that point in time? More providence. But so here you have, and matter of fact, if you were to look at these little noisemakers, what you see on there is a picture of Haman leading this horse, and who's sitting on the horse? This regal looking horse, but Mordecai, you know, he's sitting up there. So Haman is leading Mordecai throughout the city. That's what's on these little noisemakers that you heard earlier. And so this is just tremendously embarrassing to him, very frustrating. He goes home, and his wife actually speaks truth to him and says, if you're opposing the Jews, your plans will surely fail. And she was speaking more truth than she recognized, I'm sure. So the king and Haman go in to dine. This is the second banquet. And what is the petition? We're in chapter 7. And so you have three people sitting together at this private dinner party, and Esther describes, after the appropriate terms of endearment to the king and subordination to his authority, that there is someone who has vowed that my people should be destroyed and killed in their entirety and annihilated, destroyed, killed, annihilated. And it says, if all we were going to do was be sold as slaves, I wouldn't have troubled you, but someone wants to completely wipe us out. And she identifies herself with these people. My people. Now, she's been told earlier not to disclose her identity. Here she says, my people. So she's showing, I am a Jew. And she identifies herself in that fashion. Well, who is he, King Ahasuerus? You can imagine his anger is starting to mount. Where is he? Who would dare presume in his heart, verse 5, to do such a thing? Well, Haman hears the words in verse 6 that surely his heart must have just literally stopped in his chest. And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. And he has no place to go. There are three of them sitting together at this dinner party. You can imagine everywhere the king went, he was surrounded by guards. There was no one that got in or got out. His security was impenetrable. And so here is Haman. And the king, his wrath is mentioned more times than once. So his wrath, he just becomes livid. And he's been drinking wine, and who knows what condition he's in. But he just has to go out for a walk. He just can't control himself. So what does Haman do? He decides to cast himself at Esther and seek her help. Well, then comes the king in and sees Haman on the sofa with his wife, and that's it. I mean, that literally pushes this beyond the point of repair. Would you assault my wife as I'm standing here? And so what do we do? Guess who built this gallows? Well, it was built at Haman's directive very shortly beforehand, so that Mordecai would be hung on that, and he had prepared the device of his own execution. So the king says, well, hang him. And they did. And the king's wrath subsided. There's more than a few occasions where the king becomes inflamed and something happens, and then, you know, his wrath has subsided. Well, chapter 8, so Haman is now out of the picture for obvious reasons. And so now the pivotal people from this point forward are Mordecai and Esther. Mordecai is elevated to a very high position, and because of his affinity with Esther, because of his relationship with her, and what ultimately occurs is there is a request. She goes again into the inner court. The golden scepter is extended. What would you like for me to do? Remember that the earlier decree could not be revoked, and so throughout 127 provinces, at the end of the year, so a number of months have occurred, there's still, in God's providence, there's a distance of time that it wasn't, this decree to annihilate all the Jews wasn't so quick that it couldn't be undone, and now there's another decree. Well, let's give the Jews permission, indeed enable them to protect themselves, and so this decree goes forth. And it's couriered throughout the entire provinces of Persia, all 127 provinces, of, and so the Jews are authorized and energized to defend themselves. And you can imagine that they had the support of the king's nobles at this point because of this decree that went out. And so the Jewish tradition is that the Amalekites were the ones that came after the Jews. There's no indication exactly who went after them, but the testimony of Scripture is that hundreds of people, thousands of people, 500 as I recall in Susa, and 15,000 as I recall throughout the entire province were killed by the Jews in defending themselves. And then it required a second day. She said, well, let's give this another day to work itself out here in the capital. And so it went 2 days, and the Jewish people rightfully celebrated the fact that they were delivered. And so there was a letter that went out from Mordecai saying, we need to give, we need to honor this day. We need to celebrate this day. He doesn't say we need to honor God. He just says we need to celebrate this day. This day is Purim. And the reason it's called Purim, I skimmed over this earlier, is when Haman had been calculating through his diviners and astrologers and all of these people, when would be the day that the gods would grant favor on this evil plan. They cast lots, and Pur in Persian, Purim would be plural, and so that's where the name Purim came from, or Purim was lots, the casting of lots. And so that's the origin of the celebration of Purim, the Feast of Purim in chapter 9. And then King Ahasuerus gathers all of the people together, and the account of Mordecai, it says, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles? And Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus and received honor and accomplished the peace of all of his countrymen. So that's the story. You can see this very elaborate chronicle of the deliverance of Israel at the hand of Haman. And so what I'd like to do is focus on the time that remains about this doctrine of providence, because we need to understand that what's the primary purpose, the theme of Esther. Well, clearly it's about God sparing his people. God said earlier in Genesis 12, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And clearly this was in keeping with the Abrahamic covenant and God's covenant relationship with his people. God never abandoned his people, has never abandoned his people. He spared them. He punished them mightily because of their apostasy, but never turned his back upon his people. He never disclaimed them. He swore by his own name that they would be his people. And so this is an outworking of God's covenant faithfulness to his people, and sparing them against just immeasurable odds on a human level by working through his hand of providence to deliver them. That would be the historical reason for the book of Esther. But the undercurrent that is clearly here, and it should be a form of great encouragement to us, is the doctrine of providence. And I'd like for you to look in your handout at the very last page, and I'd like for you just to take note of a few things. There is a definition of providence excerpted from the London Baptist Confession, chapter 5. I'm just going to read parts of this, but this is a very good definition of providence. God, the good creator of all things. It begins by recognizing that providence is a function of God creating all things, and therefore they're all his, in his infinite power and wisdom. So what's the energizing force behind providence? It's the wisdom of God, the power of God, and all in infinity. What does he do? He upholds, he directs, he disposes, and governs all creatures and things. There is nothing that is outside the disposition of God's control. Nothing occurs that is outside God's control. From the greatest, even to the least, by his most wise and holy providence. Why? To the end for which they were created, that God would accomplish his perfect. God's will is never frustrated. It's never thwarted. There is nothing that man could engineer that would ever unseat the plan of God. So that his the end for which they were created, according to his infallible foreknowledge. God knows all things before him because he's sovereign. He controls all things. And the free and immutable counsel of his own will. Who can thwart the will of God? No one. Nothing can thwart the will of God. And the ultimate reason, to the praise of the glory of his wisdom, power, justice, infinite goodness, and mercy. That's providence. It's the outworking of his control as creator of all things, motivated by his infinite wisdom and power to accomplish his ends, ultimately so that he might receive glory and praise as a result of these things. And there's a number of passages that would be helpful for you to look at. The second paragraph in this section I think is helpful. God in his ordinary providence makes use of means. In other words, he accomplishes his will through the ordinary use of means. But understand that he's free, of course, because he's God, to work without means, above means, and against them at his pleasure. When we talk about God working against means, we're talking about him suspending the laws of nature and doing what we call a miracle. The fact that a miracle would be an example of his providence. But what you see in Esther, we don't see miracles per se. We might call them miracles, but none of them suspended the laws of nature. None of what took place was what we would consider something like opening the Red Sea. That would be a miracle. There would be God working against the laws of nature because he's sovereign, because he's God. Within the book of Esther, you don't see God suspending the laws of nature. He's working within means. I've quoted this for you many times. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, like rivers of water. He turns it wherever he will. That's providence. That's I love that verse. That's exactly what's taking place here. So look at this. This comes from Spurgeon's hymnal. Wait, O my soul, thy master, thy maker's will. Tumultuous passions, all be still. Nor let a murmuring thought arise. His ways are just, his counsels wise. He in the thickest darkness dwells, performs his work, the cause conceals. And though his footsteps are unknown, judgment and truth support his throne. In heaven and earth and air and seas, he executes his wise decrees. And by his saints it stands confessed that what he does is ever best. Wait then, my soul, submissive wait, with reverence bow before his seat. Amidst the terrors of his rod, trust in a wise and gracious God. So those are, I've never heard of Benjamin Bedome, but this was a hymn that was written to extol the providence of God, his control over all things. Let's talk just in a summary fashion. What do we see? And there are other examples. Diane and I had a conversation the other night over dinner. I said, tell me examples of providence. And she just listed off a half a dozen of them. And we could have kept going for quite some time. Here's 10, and we could cite more. Vashti was removed as queen, chapter 1. If that had not occurred, then Haman would still have been in charge, but there would not have been a friendly person inside the palace to work with Mordecai. So Vashti is removed as queen. Second, chapter 2, Esther was the young woman among hundreds to find favor with the king to become queen. It just, quote-unquote, so happened that she was in Susa, that she was escorted into this this gathering of young ladies that would be considered, and God granted her the favor. Three, chapter 2, again, Mordecai was there to hear the plot against the king. Number 4, the king was lazy. This is quoting someone else's words, but they're accurate. Was lazy about rewarding Mordecai. He heard this. He executed the conspirators. This is chapter 5. And then later in chapter 6, he actually does something about it. Pardon me. In chapter 3, he hears about it. In chapter 6, he actually has Haman escorting Mordecai around town. Number 5, there was time granted in the casting of the lots of the poor, nearly a year between the decree and the date of its execution, to allow for King Ahasuerus' procrastination and for the Jews to prepare for their defense. So even though the secular pagan diviners, astrologers, whatever they were casting lots. Who do you think controlled the disposition of the lot? Who do you think controlled the roll of the dice? It was God who controlled all of that. Chapter 3. Esther was twice extended the golden scepter that spared her life. So twice she went in, and on either occasion her life could have been taken according to the king's dictum. And you know, that's why I talked about Herodotus. He was not entirely rational most of the time. He was a man that was given to outbursts of anger, there, a great deal of drinking, and who knows what condition he was in. But on two occasions, in chapter 5 and 8, he extended the golden scepter. This is the same one who was inflamed over Vashti and deposed her and later recognized what he'd done, and twice he extended favor to Esther. He agreed to two banquets, chapter 5. What's interesting is that Esther, in the first banquet, did not disclose her reason for that, for asking. What was her intention? All she said was, if it please the king, come again tomorrow, and I'll tell you what it is. Well, understand the nature of King Ahasuerus. I mean, you can imagine that under some sets of circumstances, that might not have been, well, wait a minute, you got us all together, I gave you the golden scepter, we're here. And he's had some glasses of wine at this point. He's already, you know, a volatile personality. Well, what do you want? And this gave time for the gallows to be built, for Haman to be walking Mordecai around town and to get really excited about all these things. And so she two banquets. King Ahasuerus, quote-unquote, happened to read about Mordecai's service between the two banquets. He was... So he reads about this. Imagine this. So he wakes up in the middle of the night, or he's not able to go to sleep. Think of all the things he could have said. Well, play me some music. Give me some more wine. Give me some good food. Whatever he wanted, he got. But no, read me a book. And of all the things he could have read me a history book. And so he's got 127 provinces. And well, which province shall I read to you about? Well, how about the capital province? Well, think of all the things that have taken place in the capital province. And so in God's providence, here's this story about Mordecai and intervening with this conspiracy to take his life. And so God puts his finger right on this, and let me remind you, O king, what took place. And that motivated the desire to honor Mordecai. So there was a gallows that was built by Haman, for an entirely evil purpose on which to hang him. And once the king's, this is in chapter 5, his anger subsided, he may have had second thoughts. Haman could have had second thoughts. His wife could have said, well, look, I know you were affronted by Mordecai. I know he really upset you by not bowing down to you, but you've already got a decree. All the Jews are going to get wiped out. So just be patient. He's going to get killed. They're all going to get killed. But no, they said, no, let's wipe him out tomorrow. And so build this thing. So it could have waited. And then the Jews prevailed over their enemies. And so you've got this decree that was inviolable. Another decree that goes forth. This is chapter 9. They're empowered. They defeat all of their enemies. There are other examples. What do we take away from this? In your own life, when we encounter questionable things that seem very puzzling to us, please take the book of Esther and be reminded that there is nothing that takes place that is outside of the providence of God. There literally is nothing that our sovereign God does, because he's created all things. And hearken back to the definition of providence that we read earlier, and he is infinitely wise. So things appear to be out of control. They're not out of control. The foolishness seems to be running amok. And I can give you lots of examples as I look at what's going on in our country today. It looks foolish. God is very much on his throne. His purposes are not being thwarted. I don't understand it, but I can tell you that God is sovereign and that he's providential over all things. He's powerful. Is there anything that can upset the plan of God? Of course not. Why? Because he's already decreed it. So face evil opposition, of course. Peter tells us that the enemy prowls about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. Well, God's got his people. He's got his Mordecais at the gate. He's got his Esthers in the palace. He's got his people. You are where you are because God has put you there. You may not understand why you are where you are. In this life, you may not understand why you are where you are, but God has placed you exactly where he wants you to be. And there may be circumstances in your life that are puzzling. There may be circumstances that are painful. Mordecai, imagine his grief when he saw that he had inflamed the anger of Haman. And then the next thing you know is there's a decree, wipe out all the Jews. Do you not think that there was a sense in his mind that I know what I did was right, but now what? I've now doomed all of my people because I've got this wild man issuing a decree to kill all my people. Do you not think that he felt some degree of accountability for this decree that went out to wipe out all of his kindred? Of course. Do you think of the guilt and the travail of his soul in considering this? What about Esther as she's facing very likely the taking of her own life, and she's witnessed the capricious ways of Ahasuerus over and over again? There are other examples I could give you of that Herodotus cites, but they're so vile I wouldn't even want to pollute your mind with them. But he was a dangerous guy. So she walks right into his inner court and says, "If I perish, I perish." Those were not poetic words. She meant that. Those were actual words. She knew that there was a reasonable probability that she could be executed, tortured, whatever, on the spot. And twice she did this. So God sometimes troubles his saints, puts them in difficult spots to accomplish his will in and among them. Sometimes there are perplexing things. Sometimes there are things that appear foolish. But God has his people where he wants them. He has you where he wants you. And there is nothing that can disturb, cause God's purposes to be compromised in any form or fashion. And you know that God's purposes are always good. Why? Because he's infinitely good and he's infinitely wise. And so we know that he causes all things to work together for our good. Why do we know that? Romans 8 tells us that. God causes all things to work together for the good to those who love him, to those who are called according to his purpose. Do you believe that? I hope you believe that, because that's providence. God, providence is a direct manifestation of the sovereignty of God. And your comfort in promises like Romans 8:28 should be that we do not serve a capricious God. We serve a good and wise and infinitely just God. And lastly, just I would point out, can imagine the access that we had. So here is Esther, and she has, what kind of access does she have to the king? She has access that is tenuous at best. She enters his inner court at the peril of her own life, hoping, praying, fasting. For 4 days they fasted, 3 days, that she would walk in, And God would extend mercy, and he did. And so he would issue a decree, and it had the force of law. Imagine the contrast. Who do we have access to? Come boldly to the throne of grace to find mercy, to find grace to help in time of need. Do we fear when we enter the inner court? No, we're told to come boldly. Why? Because Jesus has paved the way. There is no golden scepter that we have to worry about. There is no fear of retribution. We go right to the immediate inner court of the God of heaven and earth. Why do we not spend more time in that inner court? That's a place that has been prepared for us to be with our God, the God who rules over all. And we need not fear. We should come. We're told to come. He delights in our presence. He delights in us coming to him. So we have one who says, "Come, all you who are weak and heavy laden, I'll give you rest." And we have a God who is sovereign over all. We should be spending much time in that inner court. We should be there all the time. And that's where we will find relief. That's where we will find God providing for us. What a stark contrast that we have. The sovereign that we serve and the access that we have. And to know that the same God who orchestrated in infinite detail through large circumstances, small circumstances, through vile people through good people, through all sorts of people. He orchestrated his perfect will, and it's all outlined for us in this book in Esther. That's the God that we serve. He has not changed. He changes not. God is immutable, and his plans are perfect, and he is good, and his love is everlasting, and his mercies are new every morning. So go into his inner court and enjoy his presence.